That gum you like is going to come back in style. That gum you like is going to come back in style.
When you're walking down the street and need a drink to take the heat, smoke is smooth, smoke is cool for cat, it's cool.
Cool for cats.
Hey there, cool cat, smoke is where it's at. Chocolate, strawberry, banana flavor, smoke, it's cool for cats. It's got taste and style. It's the drink that's really hip. Smoke is smooth, smoke is cool. Smoke is cool for sip, it's cool for cats.
It is happening again. It is happening again.
Excuse us. I was on my way home. This kind gentleman flagged me down. Asked if I could drive him here.
I used to chew it when I was a kid. That's my most favorite gum in the world.
That gum you like is going to come back in style.
Today's episode of the Plants Are People 2 podcast is brought to you by the plant-based airlines. With our new futuristic, but really technology beyond time, we've invented the first ever coma pack. For those of you that don't know a coma is, it's the structure around a milkweed seed that allows it to float by wind dispersal. Think a parachute but in reverse. A pretty ingenious idea, don't you think? Well, we've taken this evolutionary wonder and upsized it into a human-sized coma. We're not talking about long-distance travel here. We're talking about travel of a mile or less, and there has to be sufficient wind depending on the desired weight. But if you're not on a schedule, have a bucket list, death wish, apathy, or are just curious, the plant-based airlines coma package is for you. Attract and capture a bird and attach to it a note, with your name, address and check for $79.99, and we'll get a coma to you ASAP.
So, just as a, those are commercials from this product that I remember, and I don't know if anyone else remembers, this is probably like, I must have been in elementary school, so maybe I was like 8, 7 or 8 or 9, they introduced this, there was like a whole school new product that came in, and it was called Smilk, and S-M-I-L-K, and all of these kids were talking about it, and I remember like sitting down to lunch that day, and I I always had a bagged lunch, so I never really bought anything there. So I remember these kids having this stuff, and it was like blueberry flavored milk and banana flavored milk and strawberry flavored milk. And I remember being kind of jealous that they all had this new thing that I didn't have. But the next day or the day after, I remember like they canceled it because a bunch of people got sick and they were just like throwing up, and it was a bad scene. So I don't, and for some reason that has always stuck in my head. So I was looking to see if they were, what the commercials were like out there for this product, when it first came out. And those are two, one of them's kind of broken up in the beginning, but that second one with the cats, I don't know what they were thinking when they were making these ads for this stuff. And it's probably better that it's gone now, but yes, milk. Maybe some of you remember that too. Welcome back to another episode of the Plants Are People Too podcast. Taking some time today to get in some recording while I'm doing a little car shuffle. I've had the power steering went out on my Subaru, and I had to get it in the shop. It seems to be fine now, but I don't know what's going to happen. So, dropping off the loaner car, doing some errand type stuff. But this week I wanted to talk about, I'll tell you some stories from my past season in 2022, and then I want to talk about some ideas. The broad topic there is Vermont is releasing a biological control for some invasive organisms, and it'll be interesting to see if that works or not. And we'll talk about some other scenarios like that that have happened in the past, and very few of them were successful because you're introducing a non-native on top of another non-native, and who knows what the actual implications of that are. And we've been proven wrong so many times. But let's do a little story stuff first. First story, I was working a job with another guy in, it was off Mad Tom Road, appropriately named road for me to be working on, in Dorset, Vermont. And so we have this big work truck that we sort of pull around with a UTV and do some, you know, get out into the woods that way with it, and then have a bunch of gear. And this particular time we actually had a 275 gallon cube of water on the back of this flatbed 3500 pickup truck with the trailer on it and the UTV. And I was a little late that day, and my coworker was early, and so the place that you have to pull in is not obvious off the road, and so I was hopefully going to get there before him and then, you know, be able to guide him into where he needed to go. But what ended up happening was he got there before I did, pulled off the side of the road, was waiting, and there was the side of the road in Vermont, and there's sometimes big ditches, and, you know, it's for drainage. And so he was parked very close to this and tried to back up and turn around, so his wheels were already on the edge of the ditch. Tried to turn around, and he sunk, you know, his back tires went into the ditch first, and then as he tried to get out, the front of the truck slipped in because the UTV was then, you know,
pulling him into that ditch. And so when I showed up, the truck was at like a 45 degree angle in this ditch on the side of the road. And so I, you know, pulled up, got out. He was in the truck and just like sitting there. And so I was like, well, you know, I didn't know at the time that he didn't drive into the ditch, but it looked like he didn't. But the inside, so the driver's side tire inside part of that was almost touching the road parallel to it. So the wheels were almost flat on the ground, not standing straight up. And it was pretty far down in there. And so I told him just to call a wrecker. And he said, what's a wrecker? And so it's like, you know, sometimes tow trucks won't pull big work trucks out of, you know, anything, won't tow them, especially with a trailer on it. And so we were calling a few places and nobody was saying that they would come and get us. So, we were just kind of like looking for, luckily we had service. I don't have service all the time out in the woods. So we ended up just like looking for something, and this truck pulled up that I had seen actually when I was driving under, I was on 91 and they were above 91 or Route 7. And I noticed it because in the back of the truck, they were running black bears somewhere. They had one of those like dog cages in the back of the truck, you know, where the dogs can stick their head out. And so I noticed it just because of that, because I see them go up and down my road where I live every once in a while. And so these guys pulled through, and there was like five or six of them in a pickup truck with a crew cab, and they were all dressed in camo and whatever. And they, the first thing the guy said to me was, you can't park there. And I was like, yep, we're just trying to figure it out. And he's like, oh, well, you got chains? And I said, probably. And so we looked around, we found it really wasn't the appropriate size chain to be pulling a truck out of a ditch. And it was like a, you know, quarter inch chain, and we probably should have been using like a half inch chain to do this, especially with all the weight in the truck and everything. So we got a chain, but then the chain only had one hook on it. So, you know, those big trucks have like D bars where you can like put hooks into and then tow something with it. But the chain only had one one of those, and it was too short to loop through both of them and then connect back to itself. So one of the guys just goes, let's like just tie it in a knot, like an overhand knot. So we stretched it all the way out, and he tied it in an overhand knot on the like D-link on the front of the truck. And then we somehow got the trailer off the back of the truck, which, you know, pulled the UTV off. The aluminum trailer is pretty light, so we just like clicked that thing off, wheeled it back, got it out of the way. So now it's just a big truck with a 275 gallon cube in the back. In retrospect, I probably would have drained that cube a little bit, but it was like the beginning of the day and I kind of needed it. So like, I don't know, the downside of that would have been the truck would have been totally fucked, and then we wouldn't have had either of those for the day. But so we left the water in it, tied the chain to the front of the truck, and I told my coworker to get out and let me do it. So I jumped in, and it was really like a slanted position. And the reason why I told him to get out of the truck was the guy who was driving the other truck was like, oh, I'm gonna do it. Like, so I knew he was gonna like gun it. And if you're not ready when they do that, or if you've never like been in that situation before, which I've been in that situation like a bunch. You have to sort of, if you don't do it at the right time, it's just not going to work. So, and you can't hesitate, you just have to like go for it. And so I was sitting in the truck and he's like, he's going to do it. So I started, you know, started gassing it, and he yanked the truck out. The truck did a full on like wheelie coming out of the ditch because of all the weight in the back, and then like plopped down on the ground. And you know, as soon as I was out, I like just rolled for a bit and then hit the brakes. And all those guys were like cheering. They were like, holy shit, you know, like they said they'd never seen a 3500 do a wheelie before. So that was one. It was kind of a stressful situation. Oh, and then the back end of that story was I did not get out of that unscathed, although it seemingly looked that way that day. The truck was fine until like 2 weeks later when I was working in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is like 2.5-3 hours away from, you know, like home base, and just finished a job. Like everything went really smoothly. Like it was early, you know, because we had a long drive back, so we finished at like 1 o'clock and we're getting ready we're like locking the gates to the wildlife refuge and like heading out of there. And the truck was like pulling, it almost felt like the e-brake was on or something. And so I was like, oh, I don't, and I could smell like the smell of brakes rubbing. And so I drove it out thinking that it was like, I don't know what I thought it was, but I drove it out of the park and made it like down the road a little bit. And then as soon as I stopped the car, it just started like billowing smoke from the driver's side brake rotor. And that's when I knew that was not a good situation. So luckily I was in a place where I could like pull over and have it be fine, because I also had a trailer on the truck at the time with the UTV, and except this time the cube was empty. And so we found a wrecker service who came by, super nice guy. We had to disconnect the trailer from the truck. He put the truck up on the flatbed, it was like a big wrecker truck, pulled it up with a winch, got that all down, and then he pulled a hitch out, attached a hitch to the back of his truck. And these hitches were pretty slick. They had like a quick release in the center, so you could like pull out the diameter, there's this cylinder that runs through, that you can run through like a, almost like a pin, and then the ball comes off and you can just size out whatever size ball you need to put on the back to make it work. Thought that was pretty cool. And then he had like holes in the bed of his flatbed where he could just drop chains through to tie down the truck on top of it, and then cinch them down with the winch, which also was like a really slick thing. And so he hooked up the trailer, got it all towed, they took it to a shop, we left. Luckily I had somebody, the same person with me, so that I could get a ride home. And then we had to go pick up the truck like the next week and drive the 2.5 hours to go do that. But another good story was, I work for these people in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and I had worked for them I think we did the first initial work in 2018, and it was probably about 30 acres. Most of it was a wetland, you know, covered in buckthorn and honeysuckle rose, some other invasives. Mostly the edges had the bigger ones in it, so we were doing cut stump application there and then gritting through other parts of it. And so we came back, this is the first time we had been back to do a retreatment, and so we got to see sort of our work 4 years later without a, you know, maybe we did do one mid-treatment, I can't remember, but I think it was the first year that I had been there in 4 years. And there were a few, it looked really good. The species diversity in there was much more broad than it had been in the past with the buckthorn in there. There were a lot of, you know, native grasses coming back, some other native wildflowers that I hadn't noticed there before. Biden's cernua was one of those. That's one that the nodding beggar sticks, has kind of like big-ish sunflower shaped flowers, yellow. Sorry. Whoa. But so, you know, working through this wetland again, we got to notice all of these plants. There was also, it's called ragged robin. It's a Cellini species, pink flowers. I think they're native to an area more south of us, but there were a few of those in there, which was interesting. And I ended up finding this species called Lindernia dubia. And Lindernia is a species in its own genus. And I think it's the only species in that genus, actually, which is really interesting. It's a rare plant in New Hampshire. And actually in Korea, it's an invasive plant. It's an agricultural pest. It takes over ag fields. They're having a really hard time controlling it. And I guess I would think about it almost, you know, liken it to something like, I don't know, a persicaria that we have here that's invasive, that sort of like takes over ag fields. If you walk out in any ag field, you probably find a ton of non-native plants that really aren't like the, you know, on noxious plant lists that people are treating for and stuff like that. So that's what I probably think this plant is there, because it's very small. It's aquatic-ish, so it's sort of like living on the side of this beaver wetland where it's a little exposed. There's not a lot of vegetation that's taller than it. And it's kind of in like a muddy, silty, mucky type soil, where there's some grasses in there that are sort of holding the soil together. But it's got zygomorphic purple and white flowers. It could be mistaken. It almost looks like a gladiola-shaped flower. There's two variations, and I think the one that I found was Lindernia dubia, variation dubia. The other one, I can't remember the name of it, the variation name on it right now. But there's two of those, and it's rare in New Hampshire. And so the story was here. I found that. I was like, this is really cool. I went back and like double-checked to make sure that, you know, it was what I thought it was. Tried to figure out which variation it was specifically. And so I reached out to the landowner, who I was already working for. I had a contract with him. He works with a forester, so I don't work technically directly with the landowner. I sort of work for this forester. And so the forester is sort of my intermediary. And I gave him the information about the plant. he was like, cool, send me the coordinates. And then he said, I guess I was like, you know, let the landowner know I'd like to submit a rare plant form so we can get this on their list of plants to like keep an eye out for. And he got back to me and he was like, no, the landowner doesn't want to do that. He'd rather not. And then he said, like, I've had in the past when I've done this, I've had a hard time working with the agencies that come out and do the surveys for these plants. They either can't find them or, you know, just it sounded like a lot of organizational type stuff for him was getting in the way of him actually doing the reporting on these plants. And, you know, I feel like if I had been the one to have that conversation with the landowner, maybe things would have gone differently, because I don't understand why it's like, I probably would have just done it and gone out there to show them the plant and like have those conversations, and that would have been the value for me out of it, not like I'm not getting paid for this and it's just a plant. And of course, not everyone sees the plant world, the native plant world, the way that I do. And like, you know, to me, that's what's cool about doing restoration work, is like having a purpose. And like, these are the plants that, you know, are here, and this is their habitat, and this is where they, we need to like preserve these places. And so we've done that, but not with that particular plant in mind, but like, to me, that would be something to add to the report for that property. Like, hey, there's rare plants here, the state knows about them, blah blah blah, whatever. So that report for that plant never got made, and I didn't report it because of the, you know, what the landowner wanted to do with it, and it's his property. So that's sort of a success story and a failure story, I feel like. I've had other examples where we have found Artini species on properties and the landowner was psyched about it. They wanted to do something about it. They wanted to manage their property with these things in mind. So, you know, one of those was Triphora, Trianthophora, the three birds orchis that I found maybe around the same year in 2018 in Dummerston, Vermont. In that same year, there were a number of others that were discovered. I actually just went back to check on those recently, and I didn't know exactly where they were, because the reason why we found those was we were doing some work. They were logging in the area, and we were doing some pre-cutting work for that. And when I was cutting, I came across them, and I was like, this is cool, and started looking them up and finding out what they were. And supposedly they only bloom on like a 3-year cycle or something. And so, you know, I reached out to the forester, and they got in touch with the landowner, and they got in touch with the state. So they like found that population, and there was one found on a neighboring population or neighboring property. And so all of those got protected, and then there were some other ones found in Newfane that same year as well. And so I went back to check on these just to see if our management approach to finding those plants during an active logging job, which was like, you know, this has to happen right now, and luckily the landowners were into that. And so we ended up putting like a 50-foot buffer all around these plants, and that made sense because they really like deep leaf litter. You know, it's attached to this really, it's kind of a little finger that comes out off this older part of the forest, which is where they would like to be. And so in that way, we were able to, like, preserve those plants. And I'm sure there's other populations of that plant on that property somewhere and the neighboring properties. But they did flower this year, although I wasn't there during flowering time. I was there about a month too late. But I could still find... It took me a while because I hadn't been there in 4 years. The terrain looked different. And so I was walking up into this zone where I sort of remembered finding them and, like, what it looked like. I could tell you what like, side of the hill it was on. And it was very, like, you know, microscopic view. So I wasn't, like, looking around and being like, oh, there's, you know, whatever. But I got up in there and I found them. It took me a long time because they're so tiny in comparison to everything else. And they're sort of, like, color of... you know, the leaf litter around, but in true form, I feel like every time I can't find something, I sort of give up. I'm like, God, it's not going to be here. You know, as I'm doing that, I'm walking out, it'll be like right there, and I'll be like, oh, how did I miss this the entire time I was looking for it? And so they were there, they flowered this past season, and they had, you know, fruiting pods on them. So that was great to see, you know, a success story like that in, you know, coexisting logging and, you know, plant conservation. And then the opposite of that, sort of like, you know, treating habitat restoration for forestry, which by, you know, happenstance also preserves native plants. I guess, you know, as long as I'm the one doing the work in the future in that area, like, those plants will be fine because I know about them. But long term, I don't think, you know, me holding on to that information, you know, especially if with like a landowner transition or a forester transition, what if, I don't know, they couldn't really do anything in the wetlands, but they could hire an organization that, you know, might just blast through there with something and totally, you know, kill all that stuff. So, the next thing I want to talk a little bit about is phenology, F-E-N... P-H-E-N-O-L-O-G-Y. The study of, you know, when plants set fruit, when they flower, any other, like, leaf out, seed dispersal. There's all of these events that sort of happen at certain times in a plant's life, and some of these things, if you record them, you can gain a lot of information from this stuff on how the blooming windows for plants, if it's changing, if it's shifting in any direction, becoming earlier, becoming later, fruit set, you know, bud formation, all of that stuff. Is important information to gather, and this is, you know, getting triggered from finding, we had a hard frost a couple nights ago, not last night, but the night before, and I was out in the woods yesterday and found Geranium robertianum, cranesbill geranium flowering on the side of this little slope with a bunch of carex species, what's it called, plantain leafed carex, up on this rocky slope, and then there, these geraniums were just like popping off in there, and it's, you know, surprising because it's really the end of the season, and it's November, it was November 9th yesterday, so Vermont, November 9th, geranium, robertianum, is that shifted in any way, you know? And if you have all these little data points for where things are happening, you can start to paint a picture of what's really going on.
So I was doing a little research on phenology just on the computer, and I came up with this group called the USANPN, National Phenology Network, and I reached out to their director. Her name is Teresa. Teresa Crimmins, and hopefully I am going to be talking to her on a future episode really soon, so we'll get a little bit more in depth about what they're doing and everything, but I'd like to just read from their website for a second. So the question is, why phenology? Phenology is nature's calendar. When cherry trees bloom, when a robin builds its nest, and when leaves turn color in the fall, phenology is a key component of life on Earth. Many birds time their nesting so that eggs hatch when insects are available to feed nestlings. Likewise, insect emergence is often synchronized with leaf out in host plants. For people, earlier flowering means earlier allergies. Farmers and gardeners need to know the schedule of plant and insect development to decide when to apply fertilizers and pesticides and when to plant to avoid frosts. Phenology influences the abundance and distribution of organisms, ecosystem services, food webs, and global cycles of water and carbon. In turn, phenology may be altered by changes in temperature and precipitation. Changes in phenological events like flowering and animal migration are among the most sensitive biological responses to climate change. Across the world, many spring events are occurring earlier and fall events are happening later than they did in the past. However, not all species are changing at the same rate or direction, leading to some mismatches. How plants and animals respond can help us predict whether their populations will grow or shrink, making phenology a leading indicator of climate change impacts. So that's a... There's another part here. It says critical applications of phenology include management of invasive species and forest pests, predictions of human health-related events such as allergies and mosquito season, optimization of when to plant, fertilize, and harvest crops, understanding the timing of ecosystem processes such as carbon cycling, assessment of the vulnerability of species populations and ecological communities to ongoing climate change. So this is the USANPN, the National Phenology Network, was established in part to assemble long-term phenology data sets for a broad array of species across the United States. Scientists use observational data in the National Phenology Database and models such as the spring indices to understand how responsive species and phenological phases are to changes in climate across time and space. This information can be used to determine the extent to which species populations and communities are vulnerable to ongoing and projected future changes in climate. So if you want to check out that website, usanpn.org. I have heard back from Teresa, so hopefully she'll be on an episode soon just to talk a little bit about what they're doing, maybe some interesting findings they've had. And so we'll learn more about that together. But, you know, today is the 12th, so November 12th, and it's probably like 65 degrees outside right now. It probably should be like 35 degrees or, you know, in the 40s during the day, but we're 25 degrees above probably what a normal temperature would look like. And we really haven't had a frost, you know, a serious frost. Some of the plants have died back, but there's still plants up in the garden. Goldenrod is still flowering. And an update on that, Symphotrichium species, the Georgianum, that is starting to color up, and it's like, I don't know how many, maybe I have another week until they open fully, but they're just starting to like sort of uncurl their petals. And that is the largest of that genus, largest flower in that genus. But next week, you know, tomorrow it's going to get down to, yeah, I mean, it looks like we could have snow on Wednesday, so it's going to jump back into the, and it's going to be in the 20s overnight for the next 6 or 7 days. So we're going to be well into the cold season. I don't know if that plant is going to make it to fully bloom. But it is interesting to think about, you know, the planning for planting that would take place based on phenological changes, and I really hadn't thought about this insect development and if things are changing at, if plants are flowering sooner and the insects aren't there yet to use that nectar, those plants don't get pollinated, the insects miss their, if they're a specific insect, they're missing their window to use that resource. And if they're a generalist, they can probably use something else. So, you know, we're talking about a shift in general to more general pollinators and away from very specific pollinators, which is a decrease in biodiversity. But if there were certain plants that sort of were flowering earlier, you know, it'd be interesting to think about what we could do to sort of head that off and not have, you know, those specific insects that need that plant, you know, not be able to survive a change. And I don't know, maybe that's a bigger question too. You know, maybe that is something that it's already happening as we sit here now. There are species going extinct all over, so in my mind it makes sense to try to save as many of those as we could, but you know, who knows what's gonna happen. So yeah, there's we'll be talking, sorry Cecius, again, just, sorry about that. The other update is, I also have, I have merch available now, through a Bonfire store. So the website is bonfire.com, bonfire.com/store/plants-r-people-2/. You can probably just go to the Bonfire website and, type in Plants or People 2 and have it come up. And there's a link on my Instagram at plants.r.people.2. Or you can send me a DM and I can send you the link for it. But there's a link in my bio there. So there's two different shirts available right now. In true, I don't know if I'd call myself a deadhead. I used to like the Grateful Dead a lot. I'll still listen to them. But I ripped off a Steely. So I put the hollow image of the Steely in with some fireweed, and so that's in the middle of that. And then I put fireweed on the mountain, fire on the mountain reference. And then on the back it says plant, native, or die. And I think we all know, actually, if you don't know, we really do have to save our native plants because they are sort of the basis of all our food chains for insects and wildlife and everything else. And ultimately, if we don't plant native and lose all of these native plants and insects, our wildlife goes away, our water quality is going to go away, our forests go away, there's a whole, and then we go away, we literally die. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why we should be planting native. So there's one t-shirt that's the Steely there. It's available as a hoodie and in women's clothes. And then I also have another one with a Fengrass and Parnassus flower in it that says plant native or die. And that comes on a t-shirt or a baseball tee. So jump on there and check those out. They'll only be available through 12/12. I'm new to Bonfire, so I'm just trying to figure out how it works. But it seems like it'll be pretty cool to use. I ordered a couple myself to see what they come out like. So, yeah, if you're in the mood looking for gifts or whatever, want to support native plants. I also submitted my report for this past season to the New England Botanical Society, for my Collinsonia canadensis research. And I am going to be putting together all those, rare plant survey forms soon. But ultimately, you know, thinking about sort of what I learned from that whole experience, and you know, I think part of it is if you can know these plants, S1, S2 plants that have very few populations, like 10 or 20 populations, known about, it's pretty easy to find out. Once you know where those data points are, you can find out who those abutters are. And, you know, that's, let's just say on average, that's like 40 letters. You send out 40 letters and you get 10 of them back or 15 of them back. You know, on this little sample size that I did, 27% of the time, you're going to be finding an additional population or an extension of a existing population already. So you could be finding these new populations really easily. And then if you're going off the abutters of that, you know, where you're finding them again, using that as another basis to jump off of and find something else, you know, all of that just keeps compounding on itself. And then you start finding these where the extents are. So I'm going to be applying again next season for some research grant money to do my research on Trichostoma brachiatum in Vermont, because I think that it's probably here somewhere. And, you know, linked to that, somebody was posting a Ludwigia species. Ludwigia, Ludwigia. It's Ludwigia, they call it seed box. It's, the species name on it is Alternifolia. So this one, if you look it up on a range map, and if you look it up on a naturalist, which a naturalist is another thing we'll probably talk about with the phenology conversation, but if you look this species up on a naturalist, it, and Go Botany, which is 6 or 7 years out of date, but the range map doesn't show it going above the central part of Massachusetts, like Connecticut River Valley in Massachusetts. And in Vermont, there's some observations, but they're not confirmed. So I think this is another one that probably occurs in southeastern Vermont, maybe Bennington area, or even like Vernon and Brattleboro somewhere. So this would be another one that's not, I don't think this one's listed. Let's see how it's listed in. Status is here. So it's called Square Pod Water Primrose. It's got a yellow flower. It is in the primrose family, and it just says absent in Vermont. So, but it's widespread in Massachusetts. So, like, you know, how can that be? First of all, it has this like weird distribution pattern where it's like in strips across Massachusetts from the Cape, it skips the next county, and then it's like countywide up through Middlesex, and then sort of goes into Rhode Island, skips Worcester County, which I guess is the biggest one in the middle, and then it shows up again in Franklin County and those two south of it, and then it's absent from the westernmost county in Massachusetts and the western northwesternmost county in Connecticut. So, absent in Vermont, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I'm still trying to get Arthur Haynes on the show to talk about species distribution and, like, how some of this stuff is determined. I'm pretty sure that what these people are going to say is that it's based on herbarium records, but based on the herbarium records that I've been looking at, there's huge gaps in it. Like, I don't know how... I don't know how that stuff is being determined, or if we should even be sort of paying attention to it, or maybe iNaturalist is going to become the new... I mean, it would be great if everything was just uploaded into iNaturalist, and then, you know, all the data would be in one place. Maybe someday that's the direction that it'll go. I don't know. Okay, well, hope you guys are having a good weekend, and yeah, we'll be having some new content coming up here soon. If you have anything you want to reach out to me about, you can hit me up on plantsorpeople2podcast@gmail.com. Check out the new Bonfire store. Send me a message if you want stickers. There's going to be two new kinds of stickers. I'll have the Steely stickers and the Plant Native or Die with the Parnassus in the center stickers coming soon too. So those will be here before the t-shirts. But those t-shirts look dope, so go check them out. Thanks for listening. I'll get you next week. Bye.